Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. And first of all, I want to explain what is going on with this show. Some of you may already know that I have a television show that started July 2nd. There's a studio in New York City that produces the show, so they do all the heavy lifting for me. I own all the content, of course, as I do with all my material. And the idea is that I only want to do one show per week. So the radio show is incorporated. The soundtrack, what you hear most of this show, will be from the television show. The only difficult part is that I have a lot of visuals, of course, in a television show. It's not me just sitting there talking head. I'm showing a lot of visuals. And so that's something you will miss if you have my books, etc. Most of the photographs, the pictures, the drawings, etc., would be in my books. But the idea is that I would encourage you to also watch the television show and then the archives. It's just on the same archive page as my radio show archive pages. Most of the people, there's a lot of people who listen live, but there's a lot of people who listen to the archive because they, just aren't there at a very specific time of the week to listen to a live show. But at any rate, the main topic I want to talk about right now is my education package. Now, this is something that took me 4 years to develop. So there's about, I think, about 190 one-hour lectures. This is designed for K-12 and university students and their parents. And I want to emphasize this because I think it's really important for parents to understand the garbage they're pawning off to your kids in school. And especially in science, it is just horrific. And then this leads off to the history of man and the whole concept of where did we come from, who are we as people, and what they're teaching your kids is that they're just a little smarter monkey than the ones out there in the jungle. This whole idea of evolution from monkeys is really absurd. It's really absurd. And the whole history of man, how man developed, it really doesn't make any sense at all. But the problem is that is all atheist science. It assumes that all of this that you see around you just happened along by chance. It just popped out of nowhere all by itself, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. And that's what they want to do, is they want to confuse kids and get them away from the idea that there's really something much bigger. They don't talk about the human spirit. In fact, they destroy the whole purpose of school today is to destroy the human spirit. And what do I mean by that? If you're just a little smarter monkey than the ones out there in the jungle, then you're just an animal. You're just like responding to your environment, and you have no ability to really make your way or understand your talents. Everybody is different, and all kids are different. They have different talents, and the schools fail completely at discovering the talents of kids. What do the teachers do? They come in with a textbook. Here's what you're going to learn in the next 6 months. It's all in the textbook. Makes it easy for the teachers, but it's really horrific for kids. And after sitting there for 12 years, if they're not screaming mad by then, they're complacent. They're driven into complacency. So what I did is I developed this course. It's on my webpage. It's 30% discount right now because school is starting. And I would encourage parents or grandparents to get this for your kids, and it's designed for kids, and it takes them through all my books, all of my the concepts of science, etc. And it shows them where the fallacies are in this junk that they're teaching your kids in school. So it's very important to really pursue this. So I'd encourage you to go there, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and get that education course, and it takes a long time. It's going to take a long time for kids to go through this, but the lectures are such that they can go at their own pace. So once again, the education package, just go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, go to the top of the page, It says educational. Just click on that and then go to the education page. You can also buy my books individually or in libraries or the CDs, the DVDs, etc. But the education package contains all the books, all of my materials, including these amazing another 180 lectures that will really get them thinking and create a perception that they're very important and not this idea that they're just like the rest of the other million kids in the country, because they're not, they're all different. Okay, so with that in mind, remember now that when I'm talking about photographs and diagrams in the lecture on the radio show, use your imagination to discern what's going on here. And tonight we're going to have some fun. This is going to be interesting. One of my favorite topics, we're going to be talking about electromagnetic propulsion systems, non-inertial propulsion systems. What is that? We're going to be talking about aliens or the possibility of aliens. And just to preface that little discussion, we live in the middle of nowhere in terms of the galaxy we're in here, the Milky Way galaxy. We are out in the boondocks, and that's an old term. Maybe some of you have heard that term when you were kids, but that means far away. And so the probability that somebody is going to visit here is pretty remote, pretty remote. However, I gave two talks at something called the International UFO Congress. At the time it was held in Laughlin, Nevada. This was 2003, 2004. And I was one of the lead speakers there. And tonight we'll touch on some of the topics that I was discussing then, dealing with electromagnetic propulsion systems. And I've written some papers, I've given talks, not only at that venue, but I gave a talk at, and by the way, these talks are available on my webpage in videos. You get to see me as a much younger person in front of 1,200 people giving a discussion. Also, the 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference, which was held in Colorado Springs, I believe it was 1986. I'll be showing a paper from that, which was published in a couple of different journals, the aerospace journals, and also the IEEE. We published that article, and you can actually find that online. You just look for that that title, and you will find my publication online. And so you can see from those early days, in fact, from the early 1980s, I was in Los Angeles looking for funding for these projects and working it into the aerospace industry. So anyway, that's another story. But first of all, I always want to talk about some issue in the science industry. And this week, very interesting article. This is from actually August 9th, very recent article, and it's from the New Indian Express. It's a publication out of India, and there are a tremendous number of wonderful, really, really good scientists, physicists in India. I communicate with them in a professional sense, and a lot of my work is well known over there. It's becoming better known as these communications continue, and I really don't talk a lot about that in public, because it's pretty esoteric topics, but what I do as far as this show is I give you the public release of the information, kind of well, in a manner appropriate for the general public. Okay, so anyway, the name of this article, August 9th, and actually it's out of 2022, but that's recent in terms of astronomy, astrophysics, because some of these topics are hundreds of years old, like the Big Bang. But anyway, the title of this, Anti-Big Bang Theory Scientists Face Censorship by International Journals. And so, interestingly enough, the international journals turn out to be in the United States, so they're international for India. Okay, it says, scientists from across the globe, including India, who are refuting the Big Bang theory on cosmology are facing resistance and censorship from journals and archives of international repute, where they get their research papers published for peer review. And so they list off a number of these scientists here, and I have trouble with the names from India, but a number of scientists, and they are talking about a journal. It's an online journal. It's called Archive. It's housed at Cornell University, where I spent a few years of my life teaching as a faculty member there in the physics and mathematics departments a long time ago, 1979 to 81 time frame. But the problem is, this is a pre-publicational journal, and the whole point of it is to have articles posted before they go to peer review, or while they're in peer review. And so it's supposed to be an open source and really not under critical review, or like you would have from peer review. But these scientists are being turned away because they oppose the Big Bang. Now, Cornell happens to be also the house where Carl Sagan lived, and he was the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy. He held a chair there, of course, and he's passed away a long time ago, but he did the Cosmos series. And of course, the Big Bang was fundamental in what he presented. Now, I've talked about this before in this show, but the scientists that are being turned away here, and some of them have peer-reviewed articles in astrophysics and space science journals. These are high-level journals. I have publications, peer-reviewed publications in these journals also. But I got turned away. I got kind of, well, let's say, just to put it mildly, blackballed, because in my days at Cornell, I was opposing the standard norm, and I still am. And I was right all along. But anyway, they're bringing up a man named Halton Arp. Now, Halton Arp, he's passed away, he's deceased. But he spent a lifetime cataloging galaxies and quasars, and noting that the quasars were associated with galaxies, although they had very different redshifts. And so you'd have a quasar, a very high redshift quasar, attached to a galaxy. And not just one, but hundreds and hundreds of them. And so, and you could see this attachment in the various wavelengths of light, from infrared, visible, ultraviolet, X-rays, and sometimes higher energy, even higher energy light, electromagnetic radiation. And so how could this be if these things were, if the quasars were very distant? And maybe if there were one, you could say, oh, well, it's just an optical illusion, but he found hundreds of them. And in my work, I explain why the quasars have a high redshift, because it's an internal property of the star, and I'm not going to go into all the theoretical work. But anyway, I just want to point out that this science industry, the Big Bang, these people are not going to go down without a fight. They don't want to take no for an answer. Now, what would you do with your kid if you told them something, you know, this is not the way things work, this is not the real world or whatever, and they just won't take no for an answer? And that's what's going on in the scientific community. So anyway, I wanted to point this out. Very interesting article, and that's something I work on in the background too on a constant basis. I just had a paper published recently in a peer-reviewed astrophysics journal dealing with this very topic. Dealing with the, and basically Rewriting Cosmology was the title of the article. You can find these online. But anyway, that's the scientific topic for the week. And now let's jump in for some interesting dialogue here. And by the way, I have a lot of visuals tonight, so you won't be just looking at me. I know I'm fun to watch, but we're going to have a lot of visuals here instead of looking at just my face tonight. But first of all, I want to go through some history here, some of my history, to put this into perspective. There are two types of electromagnetic propulsion systems that I've designed. And this was back when I was younger. It was in the post-Cornell days, early 1980s, and you would not design an electromagnetic propulsion system if there weren't something out in outer space in terms of electromagnetism to push against. And so let me first of all explain what an inertial propulsion system is. If you go to down to the Cape, you'll find rockets going off. You find SpaceX there. You find NASA's got, and then a lot of private companies. There are private space launch facilities around the country, around the world, shooting rockets off. And so what happens, you see that big flame coming out the back end, and it's literally what's going on is you're heating up gases to a very high temperature, and they're coming out the nozzle, and it's basically Newton's law. You push something in one direction, and the rocket goes the other direction. Very simple physics, but a lot of complicated engineering to make it work. That is it's called an inertial engine. Inertia meaning you're making something go in one direction so you can go in the other. A non-inertial propulsion system is one in which you don't carry any mass. You have another system of propulsion, and the way this works is you have a current that is contained. And I'll be showing some pictures here to make this a little more clear. But you push against existing magnetic fields, but in outer space or in Earth's atmosphere or under the ocean, wherever you want to go with propulsion from magnetism and electromagnetism, to have a magnetic field, you have to have electric currents, especially in the plasma environment of outer space. So what I did in my work, and this I already had nailed down in the late 1970s, was where these electric currents were in outer space, because Earth has a magnetic field. It's a geomagnetic field that's locked into the iron and nickel primarily in the mantle in the crust of the Earth, and it produces a magnetic field, and it goes in a northerly direction, and that's that little compass you hold in your hand, the Boy Scout compass, and it points north. Or the ship compass, whatever, is a magnet and it points north. And now this is different in this modern age of telephones. You can get a GPS north, which is very exact, but that does not depend on the magnetic field. That is from GPS giving you true north, and that's a very accurate north. But magnetic north is due to the magnetic field in the Earth, and it can vary a lot. And so there are places where there are anomalies and the magnetic compass just does not work. But back to propulsion systems. If you have you can design a propulsion system that pushes against naturally occurring magnetic fields. But in outer space, there are no naturally occurring magnetic fields that are just like the Earth's magnetic field locked in. They are plasma magnetic fields, and they are caused by electrical currents. And so you have to know where these electrical currents are. And so anyway, I want to start off here. I have a book called Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. And in there, I talk about electric fields. In fact, around Earth, we have 17 of them, local electrical batteries, I call them. In the battery in outer space will discharge, but when they discharge, you have to have a form of voltage that keeps them, the batteries charged, so to speak, because they're plasma. If not, they'll just neutralize in a New York second and go away. So anyway, the book Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather explains how these electric fields occur, causing electrical currents, which in turn cause the magnetic fields, which are naturally occurring in outer space. So you wouldn't design an electromagnetic propulsion system if you didn't know about these electrical currents and batteries and magnetic fields. And so if you look at standard science, they don't believe in magnetic fields that are or electric fields. They just believe that magnetic fields somehow exist in outer space of their own, and that's impossible. If you look at the equations for electromagnetic fields and how they interact, how they are generated, etc., it's very clear that magnetic fields don't just self-auto-generate in outer space. You need an electric field that's sustained, causing an electric current, which then generates the magnetic field. Here's a picture that actually is from the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather book. And just go around in the clockwise direction. I'm talking about local environmental batteries. And this is a diagram of Earth with the North Pole. You can see there's a number of batteries there that I talk about. There's the aurora at the North Pole, and I'll just go in the clockwise direction. I'll be noting these. You see the cross-auroral zone voltage that is a result of a work by a man named Lou Frank, University of Iowa physicist. The auroral zone near the North Pole and the South Pole has the very same thing. You have the northern jet stream, which is an ionospheric current, electrical current, which drives the jet stream. And then the atmospheric vertical electric field, which is driving our weather systems, and I'll be talking about that also. And this comes back to a place called Atlantis. We'll be talking about that in a minute. And the technologies that they had in those days, where all they needed were glass and some rudimentary metal like copper, aluminum, and gold, which they did have, and the techniques for using those to build propulsion systems. Okay, so anyway, still going back on this diagram, you have the westerly flowing electrical jet stream, which is primarily electrons, and then you see a comet-like tail attaching to Earth's upper atmosphere, which is bringing in water. And that's another thing that Lou Frank discovered. He knew that this was happening, and he was able to sneak a detector onto a satellite and get the data and resolve the issue that, in fact, there is water coming in to Earth's atmosphere on a constant basis, and that's because the Earth is acting like comets. And so I talk about this in the weather book. So I'm just giving these general categories of local electrical batteries. Now, I wanted to show you, this is my logo from J. McCanny Science, and you'll see that the sun here has the streamers of protons that are going out in the solar wind, and there's a comet discharging the solar capacitor. And follow that line directly out from the sun, attaches to the comet nucleus, and then goes straight out. It continues out into outer space, and comets electrically have these immense structures. And then you see the comet tail, which they call it a type 1 tail, is the big wide tail that you actually see. And then you see a squiggly discharge over to a planet. And that planet happens to be blue. It's a blue planet. It's a water planet. And it's interesting because you see this symbology in all of the ancient texts where you see a snake with its jaws around a round object. And that's what the ancients were seeing in the sky. And actually, they saw this happen to Mars when it relieved Mars of its oceans and atmosphere. That's a topic for a future show. You won't want to miss that one. And so anyway, the logo here is significant in that it shows outer space. It shows the sun with its excess current of protons, which creates the electric field that powers the entire solar system. And then the comet, which is the discharge of the solar capacitor. And then look right around the head of the comet nucleus. You see the spray that typically we see. And then there's the green halo, which is a hydrogen line. And so it's the green hydrogen line, and that's because this is a shielding, an electrical shielding around the nucleus. So anyway, this is has a lot of significance in this logo. Okay, so onwards. I mainly want to bring out in a lot of information from this book. It's called Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. This was a book that I released in 2003 at the UFO Congress, Laughlin, Nevada. And it sold, actually it was released, the original release was on Coast to Coast AM, where I've been a regular guest for a long time, with my good friend George Norrie. And this, the night I sold this book, it was the title was not pre-announced. And so the first time people heard this title was on the actual radio show. And that night it sold $42,000 worth of books in a single night. Those are the good old days. That doesn't happen anymore, by the way. It actually shut down my internet merchant processor because they thought I was running some kind of a, how could I make that much money in one night and on a single book? So anyway, they made me send out all the books. This is back in the old print days, which I did. And then I showed them the receipts for all of the mailings that went all over the world. And then they turned the money over to me. But a rather interesting event that the book just sold like crazy. And then it's still probably my best-selling book. It's on my webpage, jmccsci.com. But it wraps a lot of information in here. And it talks about secret societies. It talks about the Colburn. The Colburn is very interesting volume that it was released by, there's a long history to this, but I was one of the first three people in the United States to get a copy. It had been beautifully published by the Chaldean and released by the Chaldean Trust, which was basically a front trust for the actual trust that held the books and the documents that were left over from the library of Joseph of Arimathea, who had brought all of these into England after the crucifixion. So his library was there. And there's a history where the Roman army came out, tried to burn it down, and they were able to salvage parts of these ancient texts that talked about the ancient catastrophes. And I'm going to be reading some of those passages here tonight. So anyway, that's a wonderful book. It includes a lot of information. This is the back of the book, and I'm not going to dwell on that. But I talk about Atlantis. Now, Atlantis, there's a lot of speculation. Where is Atlantis? The reality is that was discovered, and I found out myself. I'm not going to say how I found out, but back in the, oh, probably in the 1990s, I was made privy to this information that the U.S. Navy, working out of Northern Australia, the submarine fleets were excavating Atlantis in the South China Sea, where it had gone under, literally, and when the table of Atlantis. But the Pillars of Hercules are, you see the arrow there, that's the Sunda Strait between off of Sumatra. And that's where they entered. And the Pillars of Hercules were the two volcanoes, Krakatoa and its sister volcano, which were on both sides of that entryway. And the mariners could see this for a long distance away, hundreds of miles out to sea. They could see the glow of these pillars at night. Now you can see as the line there, the orange line, and then the orange region there is the outline of where Atlantis was, more or less. And anyway, that's just part of the story. However, the reason I'm mentioning Atlantis in this discussion is because they had technologies, and this was the title of the book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And so I'll be putting these pieces together. But basically, the technology that I basically, I'm not sure if you want to say rediscovered or discovered, you only need glass, the ability to work with glass and then high tensile glass, which is just certain chemical properties that you put along with regular glass. And then copper, aluminum, and gold, which are all used in electronics. And so they had these abilities and also knew about the vertical electric field and discharging it. Now, I also want to mention briefly the pyramids, the Great Pyramid in Egypt, which had the golden cap. Now, that wasn't there just for decoration, that was there as an electrical collector. And so my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, breaches these topics and what Tesla was doing at his Wardenclyffe Tower and his Colorado Spring facility. He was tapping into the vertical electric field, and to do that, you needed circuitry. And there again, at Atlantis, they had what were known as sea water batteries. because if you take two different types of metal, the electrical surface potential is different in different types of metal, and you can create an electrical circuit with just by putting those pieces of metal there, bimetallic strips they're called. And so at any rate, that was the voltage that then was used, and then something called in electronics a Schmitt trigger, which is a very simple, it's just a contact where you close. And then the Tesla tower, which is a harmonic oscillator with a coil, copper wire wrapped in a coil. And then what he was doing at his Wardenclyffe Tower, Tesla was, I talk about this in the book, I'm not going to go through all the details here, but tapping into the vertical electric field, and then that energy that was coming down was electrical energy. So at night, if you came into Atlantis, it would look like an airport with this column with Poseidon was at the giant statue of Poseidon was in the central ring of the five-ring city of Atlantis with his pitchfork going up in the air. And that was the contact with the vertical electric field, and you would have seen these propulsion systems, which I'm going to show you in a minute, riding up and down the magnetic field of that vertical electric current that was tapping into it. So it would have looked like a light show in an airport, except instead of the planes coming in and landing on a runway, they were coming down and landing vertically and taking off vertically. Okay, so at any rate, this was the location of Atlantis. And by the way, this is a very electrically active part of the world. When NASA goes over this region with satellites or with the space station or whatever, they shut down communications because this area is so electrically active. Okay, so here's the table of contents of the book. And I just want to note a couple chapters here, talking about the world that was, and then the earlier world before the Great Flood, and before the antediluvian world and Atlantis. And there's actually a great book on that topic by the old lieutenant governor of Minnesota from the 1800s. But I talk about that in the book. Atlantis before the fall. What was Atlantis like? I describe it in this book. Then the beginning of the end. What was going on in Atlantis? And we know about that from Solon's visit to Egypt, the great uncle of Aristotle, and coming back with information from the priest cults of Egypt saying that's why we have the information about Atlantis, and that they were having a war with the Greeks at the time. What we know as the Greeks lived through a great catastrophe, a worldwide catastrophe, and they were the mountain sheep herders, basically, who survived the Venus event. Okay, so this is part of history. It's all described in the book. It says, the night the world died, the Great Flood. That's an amazing chapter. It talks about the Great Flood. And then rising out of the ashes, what happened after these major earth-wide events. And then I talk about the next 1,000 years, the Colburn, a link to the past. And like I say, I was one of the first three people in the United States. I introduced the Colburn to the public in this book on, like I say, a major international radio show and then at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, where I had a book signing. This was the official personal release of the book. And then rising out of the ashes, the next 1,000 years, the Colburn, secret societies. Now, you have to understand that a lot of the ancient knowledge was lost, and the secret societies that are still operating in the world today were seeking this information. And I happen to be a physicist in Tier 1 ranking at Los Alamos, where I visited. I was an invited speaker talking about my work. The Aerospace America Air Show, many private presentations that I gave in what I call military science to the U.S. military, and also, like I say, at Los Alamos. And the secret societies who control basically right now the world banking systems and science, and I talk about that on this show, and then the rise of modern science, Tesla, the Black Century from 1900 to 2000, I talk about that. Will man survive? Electric Highways to the Stars, which was the talk, the discussion I had, the talk I gave at the U of L Congress, and then anyway, I'll show you some more of these things in a minute. But that's the table of contents. This is a really important book. Here's a diagram of the Earth. You can see the magnetic field lines and the electrical currents, the eastwardly moving ionospheric belts in the northern and southern hemisphere, and then the westerly moving electron belt around the equator that drive the equatorial storm systems. Here's a diagram, just a simple diagram of the vertical electric field from the ionosphere to Earth's surface. Here's a picture. This is actually from a volcano in the South China Sea near where Atlantis was. At night, this is a picture at night of the volcano just basically with electricity shooting up into the sky. And the way I view it is, you know, it'd be like the Polynesians learned how to swim because they lived near the ocean. You know, if you grew up in the middle of a continent and had no lakes or water around, you probably wouldn't be a very good swimmer, unless you had a pool or something nearby. But, you know, without water nearby, you would not become a natural swimmer. The same is true of electricity in the South China Sea, where it's very electrically active. And so they learned how to use this atmospheric electricity to harbor it. And here's some other examples of atmospheric electricity. Here's a tornado with a big lightning bolt coming down right beside it. Here's a hurricane on Mars, which is very interesting because they tell us that hurricanes form from warm water. Well, there's no water on Mars, let alone warm water. And there's a full-blown hurricane five times the size of Texas on Mars. And so anyway, I talk about that in my books also. Here's another tornado in, I believe this was in Iceland, coming off the top of one of the volcanic active regions there. You see the arrow pointing towards it. And then, okay, now here's what I wanted to talk about. This is one of the main points of this discussion. A contained plasma magnetic propulsion system and advanced propulsion concept. Now, this was presented at the 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference, which was a closed military meeting, basically. So this is the first page. This was also republished in IEEE. And here's the list of parameters. And at the time, I was president of a small company called Satellite Technology, Inc. And this copyright is, because I published it in this journal, published by the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And so anyway, this is the paper that I want to show you. Now, the concept is that you have glass tubes, which you run very high currents through, and then you have electrical interfaces at the end, which is noticed here. So you have a very high vacuum in the tube. So these are vacuum tubes, like a neon light, literally, but very strong, typically quartz instead of what you might call glass. But this is a picture of the basic design. And then it is used in various applications, like this would be for docking or momentum transfer between two spacecraft using magnetic forces. Now this is what I wanted to get to. Now this, can you imagine presenting this to these audiences in closed military meetings and they're seeing these? So this is literally the design of how you might say flying saucers work. That's the common term. And this was developed in 1982. And this is where the first time I presented this. But there again, you would not design an electromagnetic propulsion system if you did not know about electric and magnetic fields in outer space. And so standard science, they don't know anything about it, so they're still using rockets. And there's all kinds of other novelty forms of propulsion, like spinning something in a circle using centrifugal force and trying to throw something into outer space. You know, all of these are, you might call them novel ideas. But the real question you have to ask is, can this get us to the next star, whatever your propulsion system is? And the real problem with getting to the next star And they're finding this out, for example, with SpaceX, with their biggest spacecraft. They have to refuel them as soon as they get out into Earth orbit. That if they want to go to Mars, they have to refuel in outer space. So you have to get rid of this idea of carrying a lot of fuel along. And that's where the non-inertial propulsion systems come in, like this one. This is not throwing something out a hot nozzle to make it go. It's using magnetic fields to push against naturally occurring magnetic fields for propulsion. And so at any rate, in those magnetic fields on Earth are in the atmosphere, above the atmosphere, in the oceans, etc. And so anyway, then in the middle of this, you can see the rotating disks that give it gyrostability. This is a diagram of the different types of forces that can be drawn from this type of propulsion system, and this explains also what they view with flying saucers. It goes up, it can go sideways, it can change directions, it can hover, etc. And so this is just, like I say, this was published in, this was officially published in 1986. And there's a video that is in closed circles, I'm not sure if it's been released, of me giving the talk at the 19th International Propulsion Conference. It was held at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs. Here's a graph. This is called a specific impulse graph, and it's a measure of the effectiveness of a propulsion system. So you have all the various different types of propulsion systems here, and the magnetic propulsion system would be up in the region where none of these other propulsion systems can go, in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, so at any rate, that's a little bit about these propulsion systems. So I wanted to present this because there's a lot of discussion now about UFOs, etc. Let me tell you, this technology was available decades ago and understood. And so it wouldn't be surprising that some naval pilots have seen these in operation and really didn't understand what they were, because even within the ranks of the military, you have a tier level that's compartmentalized. And so the tier one level, which I was dealing with when I presented this information, is totally separate from people that fly jet airplanes. Okay, so at any rate, moving on, I want to talk now about the Colbrin. The reason I want to talk about this is because of the electrical nature of comets. So if comets are electrical discharges and they have the biggest electrical discharge in the solar system, then they would be very good places to operate your electromagnetic propulsion system. Very interesting. So if you were, say, entering another star system, coming in there and you see the planets and you want to slow down, you would do that next to a large comet. That would be the best braking location for electromagnetic propulsion systems. Or accelerate if you're going to leave a solar system. The best way to get a head start, so to speak, or a good blast of propulsion is with the electrical discharge around a comet. Now, I want to mention also there's a second type of propulsion system that is I call it a passive electromagnetic propulsion system, where there are no moving parts and no electrical currents in the device itself. And this is something that I talk about in one of my talks, the public talks, that you can see the 2004 UFO Congress. It's in one of my DVDs. You can download those from my webpage. But it's riding the electrical currents between the star systems, and that's part of the electrical current system in the galaxies. Between the stars, there are electrical currents, and you can literally ride those, and I talk about that in my talk. But anyway, so I wanted to introduce the concept of comets here, but I want to do it through the eyes of the ancients, and that's what the Colbrin is. The Colbrin is, it's mistermed a Bible. It's not a Bible. It's a collection of books that were left over from the devastation from the library of Joseph of Arimathea. Now, Joseph of Arimathea was a very rich Roman businessman who brought all the metal into Rome. Basically, from the mining was done in England, so he was basically a Caucasian Israelite, and he was working, so he brought the metal in, imported it from England, and so that's where he had the contacts with England, but supplied all of Rome with their metal. Can you imagine? He was one of the richest men in all of Rome, and he happened to be the uncle. Now, this is in the Bible, don't have to believe me, this is historically accurate. He was the great uncle, he was the uncle of Mary, father of, or mother of Christ. But, so anyway, look him up, Joseph of Arimathea. But he was a very wealthy Roman businessman, and he had a vast library, which he took to Glastonbury, which was in the early days, it was not known as Glastonbury, but he built basically a monastery there for the library. And the Colburn is a remnant of that. Okay, so let me read from this, and this is talking about the ancients, talking about the natural disasters. Then, with the dawning, men saw an awesome sight. There, riding on a black rolling cloud, came the destroyer, referring to the large comet. Newly released from the confines of the sky vaults, and she raged about the heavens, for it was her day of judgment. The beast with her opened up its mouth and belched forth fire and hot stones and a vile smoke. It covered the whole sky above, and the meeting place of earth and heaven could no longer be seen. In the evening, the places of the stars were changed. They rolled across the sky to new stations. Then the flood waters came. The floodgates of heaven were opened and the foundations of earth were broken apart. The surrounding waters poured over the land and broke upon the mountains. The storehouses of the winds burst their bolts asunder, so storms and whirlwinds were loosed to hurl themselves upon the earth. In the seething waters and howling gales, all buildings were destroyed. Trees were uprooted and mountains cast down. There was a time of great heat. Then came the bitter cold. The waves over the waters did not rise and fall, but seethed and swirled. There was an awful sound above. The doom shape, called the destroyer in Egypt, was seen in all the lands thereabouts. In color, it was bright and fiery, and appearance changing and unstable. It twisted about itself like a coil, like water bubbling into a pool from an underground supply, and then all men agree it was the most fearsome sight. It was not a great comet or a loosened star, being more like a fiery body of flame. And I'm going to make some commentary about that and show you some pictures of a comet called Halebop that fits that description. It's something spiraling around another. In other words, what they're seeing is actually two comets that are in orbit around each other. Okay. This was the aspect of the doomsday called the destroyer, when it appeared in days long ago by in olden times. It is thus described in the old records, few of which remained. It is said that when it appears in the heavens above, earth splits open from the heat, like a nut roasted before the fire. Then flames shoot up through the surface and leap up like fiery fiends upon black blood being the lava. The moisture inside the land is all dried up, and pastures and cultivated places are consumed in flames, and they and all the trees become white ashes. Okay, there was a strange silence, and then in the gloom it was seen that the waters had parted, leaving the passage between. Now they're talking about Egypt, if you can understand. The land had risen, but it was disturbed and trembled. The way was not straight or clear. The waters about were, if spun within a bowl, the swamp land also remained undisturbed. From the horn of the destroyer, the horn is a characteristic of comets, of the electrical nature of comets. So it says, from the horn of the destroyer came a high, shrilling noise. They talk about this, the very deafening noise that comes from the electrical interaction with the upper atmosphere. Pharaoh fought against the hindmost of the slaves and prevailed over them, and then there was a great slaughter amid the sand, the swamp, and the water. The great surge of rocks and waters overwhelmed the chariots of the Egyptians who went before the footmen. The chariot of the Pharaoh was hurled into the air as if by a mighty hand and was crushed in the midst of the rolling waters. Now they have discovered the chariots in the Red Sea, the actual chariots. This is a real story. Men forget the days of the destroyer. Only the wise know where it went and that it will return in its appointed hour. When ages pass, certain laws operate on the stars in the heavens. Their ways change. There is movement and restlessness. They are no longer constants, and the great light appears in the skies. Okay, so at any rate, that's from the Colburn. This is an amazing book. I highly recommend that you read it. There are other authors that have done extensive studies on this, much more than I have. Anyway, I'll be talking more about that in future episodes. Okay, now I could spend days and days. I could spend the college, 4 years of your college career talking about these topics in depth. But here's a picture of Halley's Comet. This is a normal looking comet. So in the Colburn, when they're talking about a comet, this is what you would normally expect to see as a comet. But here's a picture of Hale-Bopp, a large double nucleus comet. And you see how it twists around itself? That's what they're talking about. So this is a larger comet. In fact, it could have been Hale-Bopp because Hale-Bopp comes very near Earth's orbit. It did not this time through the solar system, but we know that that was about 4,500 years ago. So that would have put it in the right time frame for this event. But there are thousands of comets out there. We really don't know. It'd be very difficult to tell that. But this is what Hale-Bopp looks like, a double nucleus comet. And so it's exactly what they're talking about. And they said it doesn't look like a regular comet, but it's this twisted thing around, and it looks like it's on fire, like this massive hot thing. By the way, here's a cover of a book, and I highly recommend that you read this. One of my favorite authors, a friend of mine, Yvonne Whiteman, from England, and she has these amazing analysis of the Colburn. Unlocking the Mysterious Colburn, and then various books, you can get these on Amazon. Okay, so I'm going to quickly go through the dynamics of a small comet here. This is a paper I wrote in the 1980s, and this is a picture of Hale-Bopp with a Swan filter, which is triply ionized oxygen, doubly ionized hydrogen in a water molecule. So this is Hale-Bopp only seeing the ionized water, and these are very high energy processes. This is not like some like little snowball. Okay, now here's a diagram that I drew talking about the magnetic fields at a comet called Giacobini-Zinner that the U.S. had a flyby with a satellite from Goddard Space Flight Center. They went by this comet, and this diagram is one of the diagrams where I describe the electromagnetic nature of comets. This is a more detailed diagram of the spacecraft. The line there you see passing through the behind the nucleus of the comet, etc. So this is a dynamics of a small comet was a paper that I published. And that pretty much wraps it up for the visuals here. I just want to wrap this up by saying that the whole topic of Atlantis, Tesla, propulsion systems, non-inertial propulsion systems, electromagnetic propulsion systems, and the ways to travel into interstellar space with a passive electromagnetic propulsion system. These are the ways that you go into space. You still need heavy rockets for the heavy lifting to get that up into initial Earth orbit. But after that, that rocket is not going to get you very far. It's certainly not going to get you to the next star. And so anyway, we've learned a lot. There's a lot known, and a lot of this is basically really not in the public domain. And for, like I say, this is the secret knowledge, so to speak, that the secret societies want to keep. And they have all kind of things going on, like the excavations in Antarctica, because Antarctica was a minor semi-tropical continent at one time before the pole shift. And so all of the what is there is simply flash frozen in place, and they're down there excavating that, and there are places where you cannot go. It's very highly protected. But at any rate, the whole story of Atlantis with advanced technology, Egypt was a colony of Atlantis, and you know, the technology there, like I say, the pyramid, the Great Pyramid with the golden cap, it was not a tomb. It was never meant to be a tomb for pharaohs. And what happened is that the pharaohs, like a lot of these cities, were destroyed, and then the people came back and rebuilt them and lived in them, but they were not the original designers and builders. And we're learning that now. The idea that the pharaohs built the pyramids is simply not true. At any rate, also I want you to check out my book. This book is on Amazon. It's called The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. It's in paperback on Amazon, or it's available as an ebook on my webpage. So this is the kind of thing that I enjoy doing, is talking to the public about these topics. I don't color things. I don't try and put them into nursery rhyme format. I just tell it the way it is, because the real history of Earth is very exciting, very dynamic. It's not this placid place that where nothing happens and nothing happened for the past 4 billion years. No, it's a very dynamic place. And we're very lucky to have this very extended period of time of calm weather and basically not a lot coming in at us from outer space. Just remember that you can see all of the visuals on the TV show that airs. This would have aired live on Tuesday evening, August 13th. All of the archives for that are, there are I think 4 or 5 platforms with the audio and the video, the visual. And then there's about 15 other platforms where just the audio plays. And so you'll find all of that on my webpage, jmccsci.com. Just go up the top. It has in the menu, it has radio and podcast archive. So just click on that, go down there, all the different ways to listen if you miss it live. Okay, so anyway, I'm about out of time here. So once again, visit the webpage, jmccsci.com, that has the links to the water filter page, the wind energy page, the grow tower page, everything, and a lot of information, and of course, 24 years of this radio show archived there. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.